You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Susan Marcellus first achieved international recognition for photographs she took from 1972 to 1975, documenting the lives of women who performed in striptease shows at rural fairs in small New England towns. Then came her images of the conflicts of Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1970s and 80s, which earned her a number of major awards, along with a MacArthur Fellowship. More recently, she's recorded the lives of Kurdish people. Her photographs have evolved in radical ways as she's dealt with issues such as her relationship to her subjects, the use of her photographs in the media, and the impact of images to history. And she is being featured in an exhibition at the International Center of Photography. I'm sure I hear that it's running through January 4th, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Susan Marcellus back to the show. Hi.
Well, thanks, Lenny. It's a pleasure.
Why have you called the exhibit In History?
Oh, well, the curator, Kristen Lubbin from the ICP, chose that. We were struggling with what's the right title because it's not really a full retrospective of my work. But it comes from a phrase that Edmundo Desnoyes, a wonderful Cuban writer, wrote, and the piece is in the book, that my work was not in art, it was in history.
So is that the way you see it, that you're more of somebody who's creating documents rather than works of art?
Well, I think the principal motivation is to be out in the world documenting what I can as I can, you know, kind of understand it as it's moving very fast sometimes. And, you know, as the world has blurred what was categorized, you know, the boundaries are very different now. So something that works, you know, first in a magazine becomes part of a book or an exhibition, then might also live in various environments and hopefully in memory.
But there has to be an aesthetic aspect to a photograph for it to be memorable. I've taken pictures of interesting things and the photographs weren't all that interesting. And then other people, photographers, have taken pictures of similar things or the same thing and they've created something quite fascinating.
Well, there's an edge, you know, there's this edge between the formal and the content relationship. So the frame, what's inside, what's outside, space, you know, the sense of when you work with color or black and white, all these decisions that are very intuitive and very, in some cases, instantaneous. I mean, I still feel that I'm not making pictures just for walls, though if they're on walls at some point in their lifetime, it feels like it's a different moment of reflection on them.
Do you see these photographs, especially the ones taken in Central America, or ones in Kurdistan, as influencing history in any way?
Well, I think the people in the photographs really influenced history.
It was the first time I remember, the first time I ever saw Sandinista was in your pictures. And they were all over the media. I mean, you really had an incredible splash, and Americans had to rethink that war.
Well, or hopefully have since that war. I mean, there were several stages to the war, as you well know.
It's a complicated situation today, a lot muddier than it seemed at the time.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that having a presence in the media can also be kind of, I guess, the flash in the pan. Yes, there's a visibility. For me, the more important thing was bringing the work together into a sequence, a narrative of some sort that organized the material into a book. And the show is the first time I've actually made a full exhibition of those photographs.
Well, you can't control the uses of your photographs when you sell them to magazines or to other places where they're going to be published. This is a way to control them?
I wouldn't ever use the word control, but recontextualize them. So the book, and then I don't know whether or not you saw the film that we did, Pictures from Revolution, where I went back 10 years later to find the people in the photographs, another kind of recontextualizing, letting them tell the stories of their lives of those 10 years. So actually fragments of that, excerpts of that film are also in this show at the ICP, because you see a photograph as an object, a composition, an aesthetic, as you say.
But it's also just one moment in history.
It's one moment, and then time moves on, and how does that moment get re-understood by the person in the photograph or the people looking and remembering that photograph? So I'm trying to explore those ideas in this show.
You would be categorized as a concerned photographer. Do you think of yourself that way?
Oh, gosh, it's such a, it's kind of a, it's
many
a
of the Magnum thing. Photographers, you're a member of Magnum.
Concern, there's a sort of, I think the concern I have about the notion of the concerned photographer, put it that way, is that going out into the world, I think I go out with a more open sense of what I'm going to find rather than a kind of agenda of a sort. And I think that's a really special place to be in looking at history, you know, as things move in time. So you don't get positioned. You really form opinions, obviously, from the interactions you have.
So when you went to Central America, you really had no sense of what you were going to photograph?
How could I know what would have happened? I mean, I went in June. The National Palace was taken 2 months later. The insurrection that I followed very closely really began at the end of August. So several months later, no one anticipated that or how short it would be, you know, in comparison, let's say, to El Salvador, which was a dozen years of war, of civil war, you know. So I think the hardest thing for people to understand is that a photographer very often, I think this is true of my colleagues and many outside of Magnum as well, you go someplace because you feel the curiosity. It's not whether or not you're assigned. If you stay, you're really staying because you want to follow what's happening. You allow those events to kind of not dictate, you know. You're looking at, I hope, not news, but history. You know, you're trying to capture what you can. It's you can't know where it's going to lead.
Well, in the case of your photographs of the Sandinistas wearing masks, they became almost iconic. They became kind of logos in many people's minds for this insurrection.
And the uniqueness of it. And yes, it looked different. They looked different. You know, and I think one tries to be specific in a specific history, in a specific place.
And then there was also the argument at the time over whether color photography was the best medium for depicting something like that. I think that debate is over. But at the time, there were people, I think John Leonard said, the pictures were too pretty to get across the horror. And to me, what I saw was the contrast of this gorgeous landscape, all the greenery and the blue skies, and these bodies that were, you know, lost legs, where people were bleeding to death.
Yeah, well, I think that debate has shifted. Of course, no one even rethinks it so much. Now when we see black and white photographs in magazines, they seem aestheticized. I think it's okay to have that discussion. At the time, I was sort of slammed for color, and I think from my point of view, color was the best way to depict and portray people who, you know, were decorating themselves in some strange way with multi-layered clothing just to disguise their identity, but that had a function. It wasn't just an aesthetic. They weren't thinking of themselves as fashion plates, but it was fashionable to us. So we always have to bridge this gap between how we see and understand things, which is difficult with photography. It's, you know, it's still two-dimensional.
You received the Robert Capa Gold Medal for Outstanding Courage in Reporting. Does this require courage? How dangerous has this work been?
Well, the courage is not just to be in conflict, I think.
You have been shot at. And,
yeah,
and weren't you
yeah.
in a Jeep once that hit a landmine?
Yeah, that was in El Salvador. And I'm not, I mean, obviously being in crossfires is, you know, you're along with other people being shot at, not just alone. You're not being targeted. It's quite different than, you know, the tensions in El Salvador with death squads, you know, really being quite systematic about eliminating press or considering that. But I think the courage of the kind of work I do and others do is really to not know where it's going to lead you, but to feel almost possessed that you have to be there. You have to, it's the one thing you can do to be the witness, whatever you can record of the process.
My guest is Susan Micellis, who has a major show at the ICP, the International Center of Photography, on 6th Avenue and
43rd Street.
43rd Street. It runs through January 4th. Do you remember what first got you interested in photography?
That's always the hardest question. I don't think I really knew, though. I have some memories of being very impacted by film. I was just discussing with someone who, I remembering seeing Fred Wiseman's Titicut Follies in the 70s when I was in college, And
but weren't your parents photographers?
No, no. My father was a doctor. My mother was a school teacher. And
well, I mean amateurs.
My father only loved photography, but very, very amateur. My, you know, showed me how to process film in a dark room at one point. My aunt was a photographer and did a lot of portraits of families and children of families. But those weren't models in the world, in the real world, of how to be a photographer. I guess that's what I found I had to invent for myself.
And but you started doing projects pretty much from the beginning, didn't you?
Yeah, but I think projects have always been the way that I can take the time that something needs to evolve. They're very open-ended. You know, some are still going on, and some are sort of have a sense of a parenthesis that something's complete. That's the hardest thing to know, not just what when you'll begin, but when does it end? You know, you don't quite know. And some there's some surprises. I mean, I just was in Nicaragua 2 weeks ago bringing back the Nicaragua book that was just reprinted by Aperture in English but also in Spanish. And it included this film that I was telling you about 10 years later at the back of the book. So the book that had a finite relationship, you know, a structure in 81 when it was published, now is recontextualized by that DVD. And so things are, you know, fixed but in time.
Well, you said Titicut Follies inspired you, and then later you made a film. Had you always wanted to make films?
I actually... I've really only worked as a co-director in some film work. I haven't really done one myself fully. I've collaborated with two different filmmakers. I love film because it's quite a different language. So I've learned a lot. I mean, Pictures from Revolution was the right form. It wasn't interesting to go back and simply photograph people again or those places again, though I did that as well. Those photographs don't excite me in the way that hearing the voices of people in these photographs animated them and challenged them.
Well, in the Carnival Strippers, you actually interviewed the strippers, so you had their voices on tape. You've always seen this as something more than just a bunch of images that spoke for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's, though obviously I've also made many photographs that just are still, and they're just there, you know, to be looked at.
In the catalog that accompanies the show, there are images from a project of yours called 44 Irving Street. Was that your first major project?
That was the first project. It was really for a class I was taking and was done shot with a 4x5 in which there were... I knocked on individual doors of people who were living in the boarding house who I'd never met, and it was a kind of terrifying experience, that first knock and the entry into someone else's space and trying to figure out what am I doing there and how does this photograph serve them? So it opened up all the questions of the power of representation right from the beginning.
An invasion of privacy.
Invasion of privacy, and how do you, what is this activity? You know, what am I doing, you know? So bringing the pictures back to those people and seeing that they saw themselves differently than the picture or image them as, you know, that really, I think, did set the kind of stage for my own thinking from there on. And when I did strippers, those voices of managers and women and clients were very essential to the project.
Well, in the case of the Carnival Strippers, you were exposing a very hidden world, a world that we could not have known any other way other than to have entered those tents ourselves. People were shocked. People were shocked that this kind of thing was going on.
Yeah, they were shocked. And here we are now, 30-plus years later, and it's everywhere, you know? There are lots of hidden worlds that we know are there, whether or not we enter them. The whole world of the sex workers has changed rather dramatically. Sex is a much bigger business than it was then.
On the other hand, I suspect we don't have these kinds of carnival strippers anymore.
No. Now, I mean, but the industry of pornography has exploded, and if you think about what's happening online that maybe few of us actually see, but, you know, we know that it's way beyond those small communities and hidden tents in the back of fairs in New England in the early 70s.
It's one thing to knock on somebody's door and say, can I take your picture? It's another thing to go backstage for something like that and have people trust you to not do something that will destroy them.
Yeah, that, well, I think in fairness that took time, and I was lucky that one of the managers of the show welcomed me when the women wanted me to be in their dressing room, and then from the dressing room looking through the curtain and then seeing and then disguising myself as a man, and he knew that I was going to be in the back of the tent. He, you know, but Fred Wiseman has always said, you know, people don't know how they're being seen, and I think that's true. Sometimes they're so inside the world they're in, and I wasn't there really to expose it. I think that I wasn't trying to shut the shows down. I was really trying to open up our own look at who we are in a large sense culturally.
Well, Fred Wiseman and some of the other filmmakers of that generation were very concerned about not being judgmental. In the end, we wind up making our judgments as viewers because we're presented with evidence of certain things happening. But yeah, it's easy to stack something, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if it's I mean, those voices still, and actually in the exhibit, instead of, you know, the book only had the text. When it was reprinted, we were able to put in the CD of their voices, and it's that CD, those voices that you hear in the show, and it really does change the whole experience, I think, of seeing the work, to hear from them. But I don't think you walk out of there with a singular point of view. If anything, you feel the complexity of people's needs. You know, the women to be on the road and be independent, the men to need a kind of woman was different than their wife or an activity, or so they thought. And obviously there's the culture of the money and the commerce, too.
And these women were women in need for one reason or another. In some cases, they had addiction problems. In other cases, their life had just suddenly fallen apart.
And sometimes they felt freer on the road than they could in their small towns. And you know, those, you know, I was a young woman at the time, and I think that's my that's where the fascination began. Who were they? How did they perceive themselves, you know?
Well, you've gotten in touch with some of the people from Nicaragua. Have you ever gotten back in touch with some of these women? One of them, for example, was making money for college. Did she ever get through college?
She did. She did go to college. A couple of them were raising money for college. Some of them were working. The answer to the question of did I get back, when the book came out again in 2001, I guess, or maybe it was 2003, I went back and brought the book back to a few of the women that I was able to find, only three, in fact. It was very difficult to trace them. You know, it wasn't like Nicaragua going back to a corner, which is a small community, a couple of million people. You know, I had to go back to the signed releases, and then was surprised to discover that a couple of them were living back near their original hometowns, you know, after a long sojourn on the road.
And what had their lives turned out to be like?
You know, none of the three women that I spoke with at that point really had the regret of that time. One of them actually left the business very soon after I'd photographed her and became a bank teller, and complete shift, who would have guessed ever. I'm sure no one who was delivering their money in Philadelphia anticipated Stormy's history, as it were. And Shorty became a veterinarian and did many other things on the road, post-road. But there wasn't this kind of regret. There was a sense of they'd had a rough time in some cases. But they met some need, you know, that to explore, I guess.
My guest is Susan Marcellus, who is having an exhibition at the International Center of Photography on 6th Avenue and 43rd Street. And by the way, you can see a slideshow from the exhibit on our show page at WNYC.org. You talked about the transition of those women. What about the transition of you? I mean, this is one kind of a film, a photography project, but then suddenly there you are off in Central America shooting an insurrection. Was that an easy transition? Was that something that thought of, or was it something somebody else thought
of?
Yeah,
no, it was absolutely something. I read about what was happening and the assassination of the opposition newspaper editor, Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, and that led to reading about this place that was in some kind of early turmoil. You know, there were small demonstrations of students and the like. So that's what led me to leap, but you're right, it was a leap way beyond what I ever could have imagined.
And a leap in other ways as well, because suddenly now you're thinking about the larger landscape. In the earlier projects, you were either in a room or you were in a tent.
Yeah, yeah. Though it's interesting to think about narrative structure that one seeks, or what functions, you know, and that keeps the boundaries keep changing. In one sense, there was the girl show, and there were stages of literally stages, front and back stages, and then, you know, the stages of a process in Nicaragua. There was the pre-insurrection, that insurrectional period, and then the post-insurrection, and amazingly, a triumph. So that had stages of a different kind of process that also is part of what I think I was fascinated by, just to watch evolve. You know, it wasn't as compressed in El Salvador, but Nicaragua was quite intense in this 1 year.
Are you surprised to see what's happened in Nicaragua? I mean, Ortega's back in power.
Ortega's back in power, and I think the alliances are different, and some of the problems remain the same, and a lot of challenge that were not fully met at the time of the 80s when the Sandinistas were in power. Obviously, the Contra War undermined a lot of the initiatives. So we'll see. We'll see what happens now.
Does one project lead to another? Does covering Nicaragua automatically lead you to think about El Salvador?
It did at that time. I think Central America it wasn't just El Salvador, Guatemala, the later, further south in Latin America. I think the political violence throughout Latin America in the 80s just held me. You know, I didn't understand. I needed to understand one in relation to another. Some had their own historical precedents, like in Chile, that were coming to the referendum. Voting, you know, Pinochet out was a kind of amazing event. Now we're in a whole other time in Latin America. I mean, it's relatively peaceful considering the rest of the world. So, you know, I chose to stay. I just wanted to stay in Central America as best and get to know it as well as I could as obviously a foreigner.
But also, it put you in a different situation from many photojournalists who parachute in when the big story takes place. You were sometimes maybe the only photographer covering some of these events, and then suddenly there's a whole bunch of photographers covering them. Then you're alone again.
Yeah, people come and go. But, you know, the thing is that the work, it was interesting in Nicaragua, that book is known as my work, but then the Salvador Project was collecting the work of 30 photographers who were coming and going, each of whom contributed in some way. Whether or not they thought to do the book so much. But, you know, I partnered with other photographers to put that narrative together, and I think it's still very valuable, even for the El Salvadorian community today, to have a record of the work that was done by a fairly large group of foreigners.
You speak Spanish, don't you?
Now I do. It took a while.
What got you into Kurdistan?
Not Spanish.
I'm sure you speak Kurdish.
I never learned Kurdish or Farsi or, yeah, Turkish or Arabic, all of which would have helped me in some way, not to mention three dialects of Kurdish. It was hopeless to learn the language. I was very, very fortunate in the early stages of doing the work with Human Rights Watch to meet a wonderful translator, Asad Gozay, who really became a cultural translator, and I traveled very extensively with him and then others.
Did you research the story, the history of the Kurds first before you went there?
It was it was a kind of surprising intersection with Joe Connison, a wonderful investigative reporter, calling me up, having met in the Philippines, interested in the Kurds and wanting a partner to go in. And for a number of reasons, it worked out that Joe could not end up, because the war started. I then left and teamed up with Human Rights Watch at a later stage. So, you know, things don't, they're not always point A to B. It wasn't so logical, and yet I think you see this in the show, there is this connection, having spent the decade, kind of inside political violence, of course then, confronting with these destroyed villages in Kurdistan, I was taken. I mean, I was held. I felt I had to understand more about what had happened and why it had happened and why we knew so little about what had happened.
And you also took on another role here as an archivist. You weren't just a photographer recording what was going on.
I felt my own photographs couldn't really tell enough about what was going on. What was going on is what had happened.
So you got people to actually give you photographs and other things?
Well, I began to see photographs and think that photographs could perhaps open up the story or help those of us who lived afar and didn't know the Kurds to kind of understand something about their desire for a place that was distinct from their neighbors. And what was this Kurdish identity? And actually, they were contributing in little bits and pieces. It's a very fragmented history. Most of it's gone, lost, buried in some cases.
Was that before Saddam Hussein started gassing the Kurds?
Well, that was 88, 89. The villages I was photographing were at just post the Anfal campaign that killed over 100,000 Kurds. Mm-hmm. So I was both doing the villages and then beginning to document some of the mass graves along with the Human Rights Watch team, which did collect, you know, a testimony in a very detailed way. So this was long before, this was just after the first Gulf War, long before what we knew to be his trial that followed, but that some of that work became the evidence for that trial.
Have you been back since the invasion?
I went back last year. I did not go back to photograph the next invasion, our invasion, as it were. I went back with the book just last May.
And the Kurds ordered 5,000 copies. That's a big sale.
There are a lot of schools and libraries and families who had never had it, and it was important. And the wonderful thing was University of Chicago reprinted it with a Sirani and Turkish translation, so the book was that much more accessible to the community, though it had come out 10 years before. So there's a 10-year update in the new book.
Are you working on another project?
Oh, gosh, Lenny, that's always a cruel question. You know, it's a lot to kind of make sense of 3 decades of work. And there's some threads that I might pick up from the past, or maybe it'll be a new path. I absolutely have no idea.
But there are threads, aren't there?
There are always threads to follow forward, but you never know if you want to go backwards to go forward or you want to just take another leap. And where will that take you? I have no idea, really.
Meanwhile, we have this exhibit at the ICP and this book from Steidl called Susan Micellus in History. This book is as close as we get to a retrospective of your work, isn't it?
I think the book, yeah, in that sense, more than the show. What I think was brilliant that Kristin Lubin really wanted to do was contextualize actually our choices about these three seminal projects so that you experience in the first chapter the larger other kinds of domestic projects that are documentary in nature, in the second chapter, other work within Latin America and within the media, and then the third project of archival, and not just the Kurdistan project. So these ideas in taking shape, you know, and how maybe there is a disjuncture or a leap, a small leap in between them.
Well, Susan, I hope you don't keep on putting yourself in harm's way. We love you too much. Meanwhile, there's this exhibit at the International Center of Photography running through January 4th. And as I said, a book of Susan Micellus' images called In History, published by Steidl. Thank you so much for being with
Thanks,
us again.
Thanks, Lenny. I hope you'll see the show.
Susan Micellus' exhibit at the ICP, as I said, will be up until January 4th. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. You can also see some of the pictures because we have put a slideshow there. Up next, actor Richard Belzer on his debut novel called I Am Not a Cop, which blends fact and fiction. And you might detect in it a hint of his character, Detective Munch, from Law & Order Special Victims Unit. This is WNYC, WNYC.org.